Hey, everybody, welcome to the Daily Objective. And today is our first ever pre-recorded episode because of scheduling issues. But it's going to be a wonderful one. And we encourage you still to engage, maybe even super chat, especially in light of who we've got on the show. So we're going to be celebrating the birthday of Leonard Peikoff all week, the greatest living philosopher. And we're going to have various guests on all week. And we're starting off strong. I don't know what I'm more excited about, the subject we'll be discussing or who I'll be interviewing. Nikos, welcome to the show. Nikos Sotirakopoulos. It's great to see you.
Yeah, you're not excited about me. So let's go straight
okay,
to
Okay, all right. We got somebody. He's you know him. He's the
He tried. It was good.
The former president of the Ayn Rand Institute and current president of the Ayn Rand Fan Club Puerto Rico Division, Yaron Brooke.
Hey, welcome guys. Nice to be on.
Nice to have you. So you've spoken a lot about discovering the work of Ayn Rand and how that impacted you, and you eventually moved to the United States. At what point did you realize that there's this other person, Leonard Peikoff, who plays such an important role in kind of getting the philosophy from the mind of Ayn Rand into the, you know, into the hands and eyes and ears of the rest of us?
So I think sometime in the mid-1980s, early to mid-1980s in the United States, in Israel, it came to my awareness. Partially, I'm pretty sure I read Ominous Parallels in Israel back then. Couldn't afford to take, if you remember, well, you don't remember, you weren't born then, and neither was Nikos, but in those days, Leonard Peikoff's courses, you could only get them if you signed up for this, to go to somebody's house and they would listen to them on cassette. You weren't allowed to stop the cassette in the middle. You couldn't rewind. You had all these rules, and it cost a lot of money to participate in one of these. I couldn't afford it. So I think once or twice I was invited where I heard maybe one lecture here or there, but never heard a whole course. But it was obvious, from Ominous Parallels, from other stuff, and from just people who had been to the U.S., that Leonard was central to kind of the objectivist movement. But it's only in 1987 when I first moved to the U.S., really the first place I came to was the Thomas Jefferson School in the University of San Diego, and where they held the two-week-long objectivist conference. And where Leonard spoke, gave a course, I think it was called Objectivism, the State of the Art. And it was an advanced course from material that some of which ultimately made it into Atlas, into Ominous, Jesus, into OPA. God, wake up, Yaron. Into OPA and Objectivism, the Philosophy of Ayn Rand, that came out in the end of 1991. But a lot of the material that didn't make it into there, kind of that he didn't think was representative, or the things that he heard from her. OPA is very much, this is what Ayn Rand said as delivered by me, but this is as close as I can to objectivism. But there was a lot of material there that was his development, his ideas. So it was a great course. And it was the first time I actually got to sit from beginning to end to a whole course and got a sense of Peikoff's mastery as a teacher, as a deliverer of content, and as of developer of ideas, philosophical ideas. So It was quite an experience. It was at a level that I'd never experienced before in terms of somebody's thinking, and so somebody's ability, in terms of somebody's understanding of Ayn Rand and of objectivism. I mean, clearly he was the master at that point. So it was only in 1987 that it fully really resonated, the importance of Leonard Peikoff and his contribution his contribution to my life, but also to the movement more broadly.
Yeah, that must have been quite an experience. I've seen a couple of videos of Dr. Peikoff in the 80s. He had his cool mullet or whatever that haircut was. He was, he was just going through the basics. Here's our metaphysics, epistemology. It must have been amazing.
It wasn't that basic. It was, I mean, it's basic now in a sense, even now it's not basic because you've got all the work Leonard Peikoff did. And in presenting these ideas and delivering these ideas to all of us, but it wasn't basic back then. It was super cutting edge and still is. And it wasn't easy. And it was, he went very deep in some of those courses. I mean, you should go listen to Objectivism, State of the Art. I mean, it goes very, very deep into metaphysics and epistemology, particularly those first few lectures. None of it is basic or simple.
Yeah, I meant the video that's on YouTube where you see Dr. Peikoff is him. It's kind of an introductory video. Yeah, but
I organized that event as part of Lyceum conferences. We got the students. I went around it up the students. I have to take a 2-minute break because I just spilled coffee.
And then at some point you got to know Leonard Peikoff personally. Do you remember how that happened?
Yeah, so I first got to know him in 1987 at the conference. Just like every other conference attendee, you chat a little bit. I actually had a business meeting with him. Boaz, who runs Ayn Rand Center in Israel today, and I met with Leonard to ask for permission to translate Ayn Rand's essays into Hebrew and publish them in Israel. And so we had a really charming meeting with him in his room. I still remember sitting around a round table. And he was like, yeah, you know, don't even ask. Just translate the stuff and publish it. We need to get her ideas out there. And it was really refreshing. We were very intimidated. There were all these stories about how tough Leonard Peikoff can be. And we were intimidated and we were young and students. And he was, he was Leonard Peikoff. And he was charming and incredibly friendly. But I really got to know him from several events during the early mid-90s. I can't remember the exact dates of these things, but approximation. So first, I used to run a company that sold reproductions of artworks. So it was called Values. And in some variation, we actually had a physical store at some point called Art is Art with a capital A is A, you know, really clever. And we had all these reproductions of artwork. And in the 1993 Thomas Jefferson School Conference, we rented a room at the hotel and displayed all the artwork and made it available for sale. And it turned out Leonard Peikoff loved what we were displaying. And he would hang out. He would go running in those days. And when he finished his run, he would come in and flip through. We had lots of posters. We had hundreds of these, and flip through the posters and just sit there. And we had stuff on the walls and everything, and just enjoy it and just talk to me and whoever was ever manning the room at the time, and got to know him a lot more then. And he bought a bunch of stuff. I mean, to this day, Leonard has on his wall some of the art that he bought from Values back in the 1990s when we were selling the stuff. So I got to know him a little bit then. And then there was a painting he had by a Cappelletti that Ayn Rand owned, Desnudo, that had been in Ayn Rand's living room. And in those days was in Leonard Peikoff's living room. And I asked him, hey, we sell all these photographs of art. Would you let us come to your house to photograph Desnudo? And then we'd sell reproductions of it. He said, yes, surprisingly. And we went. I mean, it was myself, my wife, and another friend who later worked at the Ayn Rand Institute for a little while. And we photographed the painting at his house. And then we spent a day with Leonard. He showed us around the house. He showed us all the pictures. He told us stories. It was just this charming personal interaction that was just, it was just amazing. And it was a huge amount of fun. And really got to know him then. But then the way I really got to know him is then I became a student. So overlapping with some of this somewhere from 1994, I think, until maybe 98, in the OGC, the Objectivist Graduate Center, I was a student in a class where Leonard was the teacher, two different classes. One was called Confusion Papers, where we would write a page about the thing we thought we were confused about in objectivism. And then Leonard will show us how confused we really were and how our confusion was not what we thought it was completely something different, much deeper, much more fundamental. And those were amazing. And I wrote two confusion papers for those seminars.
Yeah, do you remember what your confusion was?
Yeah, one became a lecture. One became a Leonard Peikoff lecture that he gave at a conference. So the one confusion paper was socially metaphysical value versus socially objective value versus metaphysically objective value from What is Capitalism? What is Capitalism was one of the hardest essays in the objectivist literature. It's people think it's, oh, it's easy, it's about capitalism. No, it's deep, it's hard. She defends capitalism in a way that I can't. I mean, it's so epistemological in its nature, the essay. So that was my one confusion about what that actually means. And then the second one was, it turned into a lecture that Leonard gave called The Survival Value of Great but Philosophically Evil or Bad Art. So it's about art. It was about, why should I read Tolstoy? I mean, his philosophy is so terrible, you know, and he turned that confusion paper into a whole lecture. And then the second course we took, so that was one course. And then the second course we took was teaching class, where you gave a short presentation, just like I did, you know, not just like I did with the Iron Maiden Institute, because it was Leonard Peikoff, which is not me, it was at a different level. But yeah, basically, you present 10 minutes, 15 minutes, and then he rips you to shreds, typically. I can only remember presenting once or twice, but the once I presented that I remember was at his house. So I drove down from Northern California to Southern California and went to his house, because in those days I was living in Northern California. Went to his house, and there's a group there of people, many of whom you guys know, and presenting, and all of us did. So a lot of the intellectuals you know today were part of that class and wrote confusion papers and participated in the teaching seminars. And that's how I got to know him. And then, you know, through that, we kind of became friends, and we, you know, oh, the other aspect of this is all in the mid-90s, right? In the mid-90s, I took over the conference business that used to be the Thomas Jefferson School. So I started running summer conferences. I was also running weekend conferences, but I was running summer conferences. So I did a summer conference in 1995, 1997, and 1999, three summer conferences, all of whom had Leonard Peikoff as a lecturer. So I was in a position of negotiating what he was going to speak about, how much to pay him, what accommodation he was going to have, all of that, which was for most people quite terrifying, because again, Leonard Peikoff has this aura of he knows exactly what he wants, how he likes it, and he'll let you know if he doesn't like something.
Have you got a highlight story from that, from your relationship as you having to negotiate with Leonard?
No, I mean, my negotiations with Leonard, shockingly, and different than I think other people's experience, was always great, was always fine. I mean, not only that, but in 1990, I don't even know the year, 7, 8, we did a virtual course with Leonard, live video with Leonard Peikoff. This is before YouTube, before streaming. The internet is just a few years old, right? I mean, Netscape goes public in 95, 96, right? So this is right around then. And if you've ever seen, it's available now on Ayn Rand University, Objectivism Through Induction. That was a course that we sponsored, Lyceum, which was a company that I owned with Pamela Benson, my partner. And so we organized all these places around the country that had video conferencing equipment. And people would go and sit in a classroom and watch Leonard on screen. And it Leonard was at a place in Southern California, and I drive down and spend the night and spend the day and organize it and get it all set up. And the technical problems were just a nightmare in those days because it was all, you know, it was a new technology. And I would go to the sessions. I'd be there. I'd drive Leonard there, drive him home, you know, spend the day. So as his employer, if you will, right, I got to know him really well. And we became more and more friends. And there was a period in which together we tried Egoscue, which is this physical therapy thing. And I would fly down, pick him up in Orange County, drive down to San Diego, do the Egoscue sessions, drive back. So we landed up during those late 90s spending quite a bit of time, I think, together. I mean, it probably seems exaggerated in my mind. It probably wasn't that much amount of time because I was in Northern California. He was in Southern. But it was good quality time, and we got to know each other really well and became quite friendly.
And you traveled to Greece at one point. Is that around that same time?
Again, a conference that I organized, right? So this is a conference that we did in 1997, which involved a conference in Athens, speakers in Athens, then a boat, a cruise, that then did the Greek islands. And during the cruise, more lectures on the cruise ship. So Leonard did, I think, a famous talk that is, again, available, why Greece is his favorite culture on that cruise. But yeah, that's definitely, we hung out there. We, you know, every island you get off and you go tour around, and we did that. We had a famous argument. Leonard and I had a famous argument at a restaurant at the top of the volcano in Santorini, overlooking one of the most amazing views in the entire planet. I mean, it wasn't a hostile argument, but it was an intellectual argument about the risk of terrorism. Leonard Peikoff turned out to be completely right. I turned out to be completely wrong.
So you were underestimating the risk.
I was underestimating the risk in America.
In America.
I think they had the capacity, the ability, the sophistication to actually be able to pull. My general view of terrorists is they're pretty stupid. I still think they're pretty stupid. And I don't think I underestimating their threat. I overestimated the ability of the Americans to protect themselves. And if you read about 9/11, the more you read about it, the more you figure out that they had a million opportunities to stop this. And it was a major intelligence fiasco for the Americans. So that's, I overestimated their abilities. But yeah, so we definitely got it again, got to spend a lot of time on the Greek island cruise, a famous Greek island cruise, because I still get a hard time from people who were at that cruise because of the quality of the boat. This is not exactly, wasn't exactly a luxury. I believe back then, I mean, this doesn't have anything to do with Leonard, but I believe back then that objectivists were relatively poor and they didn't have money to spend on stuff because I was really, really poor. And most of the people around me that I knew were fairly poor. And it turns out, so I booked a fairly cheap boat, and it turned out that objectivists had money. And if I'd booked a more expensive one, a really nice one, maybe I couldn't have gone. I couldn't, but it was my conference. I guess I could have, but I could have charged a lot more money and done a better boat and still filled the boat probably. But anyway, people harass me to this day. But Leonard had a great time, I think, on that cruise. And again, we got to hang out. I was, you know, at his wedding to Amy, again, during those years, those 90s. So in the mid 90s is really when I got to know Leonard, and we became personal friends.
So I'm glad here's a question, Yaron. So when you're having, let's say, this, what would be the, in retrospect, the 9/11 argument, or how would Leonard Peikoff think about the topic? How would he form his view on a topic? So, for example, I don't know if you were around when he was writing Facts and Value. So what would be the process of thinking if you could somehow reverse engineer Dr. Peikoff's process of thinking?
Yeah, I don't think I can reverse engineer. I mean, he's a genius and he's brilliant. And he sees things before other people do. And he sees the essential, right? He does two things brilliantly, in my view. He both can see the essential in something, the principle involved, the essential concretes that matter. And then he is a master integrator. Then he can see the connection to that, to everything else. I think what he saw for 9/11 was A, from Salman Rushdie on, the appeasement, the emboldenment, the growing significance of the Islamist movement. So that's one thing. They were a threat and a growing threat. And the second was the decline of America, right? So those two things I think he saw, and he connected the two as they're going to attack us, and we're not in a position to protect ourselves, and they're going to reach it. I don't think I quite saw the decline of America quite in the same way. I don't think I saw the rise of Islamism in the same way. My vision of Islamic terrorism was an Israeli perspective shaped in the 70s and 80s, where terrorists were basically secular. They weren't religious fanatics. They weren't as committed and as crazy as with religious fanaticism, but not as fanatical as the Al-Qaeda type terrorists. So he saw much more of that and integrated all of that together. I was there when he wrote and when he edited the full page ad we did after 9/11, which is a brilliant piece, and everybody should go and read it. It's on the Ayman Institute website still. It kind of basically said, this is what happened on 9/11. This is who's at fault. This is what we should do. And if you read it 20 years later, even though it was written just, I think it was 3 weeks after the attack, it got it in all its essentials. Everything in it is true, even now that we know so much more after 20 years. We don't know anything that contradicts what he wrote back then. And it was literally, I mean, he wrote a draft, and then he and Amy and I sat there and we would do little editing and question, we would question him, and then he'd rewrite some things. And I think it was an overnighter. It was because we wanted to get it out quickly. And it was this intense thing, but you could tell his mind always finding the essentials. What is the essential about this? And always integrating it into a grand conclusion, into something meaningful and something important and new to be said about whatever was going on. And that's true of all these. So that was 2011. Yeah, 2001.
Wow. And you've helped clarify the situation for a lot of us, talking about the Middle East, talking about Islam. So the Palestinians and people like bin Laden, they were inspired by the Iranian revolution and they became religious fundamentalists, whereas maybe before that, they were more like pan-Arab nationalists that weren't necessarily that into Allah.
That's right. That's right.
So when you first started to bond with Leonard Peikoff, it sounds like art was a big source of that bonding. Would you say he's influenced your taste in art, or Ayn Rand as well as Leonard Peikoff have influenced the type of art that you're into, whether it be music or literature or anything else?
Yeah, so I certainly Ayn Rand. I mean, Ayn Rand shaped much of my view on arts. The Romantic Manifesto did. I think Leonard has reinforced that. What I thought, what to me was gratifying and really interesting is that, it seemed like when I first met Leonard that we shared a lot of similarities in terms of what art we liked. I'd say certainly when it came to painting, when it came to sculpture, we shared a lot. And then if you think about we in those days, we used to go to, in the 2000s, we used to go to opera together. We had a real love of classical music, of opera. We both liked Beethoven in spite of the fact that Ayn Rand didn't. So I'm trying to think. The thing where Leonard really taught me significantly about art and about how to think about art, how to look at art, is in the art that is primarily, that has an element of storytelling to it, if you will. And I think that in some ways, my favorite Leonard Peikoff course is his Eight Great Plays. And that's the one, that's the second one I saw live. So the first one was in 1987, was Objectivism, a State of the Art. But, and the next one, because for 6 years I was a student and didn't have the money to go and attend a conference. So the next one was in 1993, in Thomas Jefferson School in 1993, where Leonard Peikoff gave the eight great plays lectures. And those were just blew me away. And suddenly an appreciation for plays. But then what I did, and I don't even know if Leonard knows that I did this, but I did, is I took his basic structure. He has a particular structure in which he analyzes plays. That I think he got part of it from Ayn Rand, but he really worked on it and developed it in terms of how to analyze drama, how to analyze theater. I took that and used that for movies. And for years had movie nights where we applied the Leonard Peikoff kind of methodology on figuring out what the plot theme was, what the characterizations were, what the philosophical theme was on every movie we watched. And we watched dozens of movies and did this on them. So he definitely influenced the whole way I look at movies, at theater, and then at anything that has story. And then of course, novels, which I know very little about. Leonard is a world expert on literature, poetry. In 1999, another conference I organized in Grand Le Bac in Lake Tahoe, Leonard gave a course or a couple of lectures on poetry, which were fantastic. So I think I've learned from him primarily about what you'd call the conceptual, the arts that deal with concepts, right? Poetry, theater, drama, and literature. But we share a lot of likes when it comes to, the other thing he taught me about, the other music he taught me about was jazz. I was never really that big into jazz. Well, two forms of music I'll mention. Jazz, which he introduced me and my wife to in a serious way in, I can't remember when, but sometime in the 2000s. And we used to go to jazz concerts together, particularly this one pianist that Leonard really liked, Tamir, who landed up being an Israeli. The Israelis are everywhere. And we used to go to concerts together to watch him and various jazz ensembles. And that was always really, really enjoyable and fun. And then, of course, more recently, he's introduced me to, in a more serious way, is operetta. He's introduced all of us, in a sense, to operetta. I knew something about operetta previously. I've always had a few operettas in my library. But, I never took them as seriously as Leonard did and never got into it as much as Leonard. But certainly my appreciation for them has gone up significantly since he's been talking about it. We've watched some operetta together over the last couple of years, which has been super enjoyable. And so I'd say the musical forms he's introduced me to is operetta and jazz, and then the plastic arts, we often, share a liking for, and then of course I've learned a huge amount from him in terms of all the other arts and generally art appreciation. I mean, even when Leonard talks about sculpture, he talks about it in a much deeper, more meaningful way than anything I ever say about sculpture. So he sees things that, so when he talks about his experience in front of Michelangelo's Dying Slave and what the Dying Slave means, and I mean, he has a depth of understanding that is truly astounding and exceptional. And we can all learn a huge amount and do learn a huge amount from him on every topic he talks about, but art, which is a real passion for him. Suddenly he at some point studied sculpture to study actually sculpting. He knows quite a bit about it. So
Yaron, the next period is then the period where you are leading the Ayn Rand Institute, which is a period that has, the idea is to have an opening to bigger audiences without yet compromising the philosophy. So during that period where you're leading ARI, what's your relationship with Leonard, and what is his view, let's say, on your vision for ARI?
I mean, you really should ask Leonard. I mean, it's a little tricky for me to try to impose. I mean, my relationship with him has always been good and great, often great. We've had our confrontations or conflicts about particular people. You know, certainly, usually it's about people. Rarely have we disagreed about topics, and never about a philosophical topic, because who am I to disagree, in a sense, with Leonard about a philosophical topic? I mean, maybe application. You all know we disagree about immigration, and I think we disagree about other political issues, you know, concrete. But we never, you know, Leonard had a particular view of what the Institute should be doing. I always took that into account. I always try to respect that. I always try to do the things that Leonard thought we should be doing. I think I had probably a broader vision of what we should be doing. He accepted that and supported it for the most part. I mean, if you hear often the praise Leonard expresses towards me and the Institute at different OCONs over the years, some of it's over the top, overly praising of me and the Institute, but generally it was positive. Generally, he thought what we were doing was good. I'm sure the things he didn't like, there were lectures I gave where he later told me, you know, that I was bad stylistically and wrong thematically. I mean, other than that, it was great. and I always took that really, really seriously. And those videos are not online of those talks, because I never put them up, because he was right. And so it's how I think I got better, is by taking input from Leonard seriously. He attended most of the stuff he hasn't attended. So he doesn't have full knowledge of everything I've spoken on. He hasn't critiqued it. But from the perspective of ARI, I'd say, you know, we had a great relationship. The conflicts, again, we might have had are about people, but generally our friendship only intensified during the period that I was running ARI. And, you know, I think so. Yeah, there was no. I don't know if you want any scandalous information, but
no, the opposite. I wasn't going for the scandalous information.
No, I mean, I think he supported what we were doing, and he supported, again, I don't think he was involved, and I think he wasn't that involved in the detail. I don't think he kept track of everything we did. I don't know that he would have agreed with everything he did or with everything I say. He probably wouldn't have, but he chose the level of engagement that he thought. And at that level, he was very positive and very, very supportive of everything that I did, and very eager to work. You know, he came, he did OCONs, he gave lectures at OCON, he did other things for the Ayn Rand Institute. He wrote once in a while, he'd even write a fundraising letter. So he was engaged in what we did to the extent that he wanted to be engaged with it. And there were no big issues and confrontations other than a couple of times with regard to particular people, and, you know, all of those were resolved.
When you listen to some of Dr. Peikoff's lectures from like the early 2000s, and the question would come up, like, how is this philosophy going to spread? How are we going to reach more people? And at once or twice, he praised you, Yaron, saying, like, have you seen this Yaron Brook guy? He's out there talking to the media. I don't know if you could think of a better way to reach people than what he's doing. I mean, I'd love to hear about it. He definitely thinks highly of you, at least based on those Q&As that I've heard. And then speaking of Q&As, his podcast, I think, began about around the time he finished writing The Dim Hypothesis. And he ended up bringing you on board for the last year or two of the podcast to host alternate weeks to focus specifically on politics, I think, so that he wouldn't really need to. So he obviously he thinks highly enough of your thinking, even if you do disagree. Like you said, you famously debated immigration on that podcast, I think, also to showcase that you can disagree, but it's not a fundamental schism. It's just you disagree about the application.
Yeah, I mean, at some point, I think his view was that he didn't enjoy answering questions about politics. It was depressing. It was uninteresting. He didn't want to follow politics that much because it was depressing. This is during the Obama years. It was too discouraging. So he didn't want, because he felt like if he was going to answer questions about politics, he had to know something about it, which means you have to read the newspaper. You have to follow the news. You have to get multiple from multiple sources. You have to figure out what's right and what's wrong, what's true and what's false. You have to unravel and unpackage all of this stuff. And I think he didn't have the energy and didn't have the motivation to do that. He loved answering kind of the personal questions, the personal application questions from young people who just read Ayn Rand and wanted to know how to apply it to their relationship, to their sex life, to their family life, to their career, to how to live it. And he was super passionate about that and loved it. And he was beamed when he talked about stuff like that. And he loved that audience. He loved those kind of questions, and he wanted to really focus on those. But he realized there was a lot, so he basically asked me to take over the politics. And I can't remember the timing and how long, but yeah, about the last year and a half of the podcast, he did all the kind of non-political questions, and I did all the political questions. And his answers to those questions are true gems. I mean, they're just fantastic. He has this refreshing, original mind that is like Ayn Rand's, that where a lot of times the answer will be completely unexpected. It's not what you'd expect Leonard Peikoff to say about this, about sex, or about how to treat your family, about that. And it's always original. It's always interesting. Yeah, of course, completely consistent with objectivism. Causes you to think. It's not like, oh yeah, that's obvious. It's always pushing a little bit. It's always challenging. It's getting you to think about the issue in a completely different way. And his passion and love for it always came across in those podcasts. So I highly encourage people to go and listen to them, because I think it had a profound positive impact on a lot of young people being introduced to objectivism and struggling and really challenged to apply it to their day-to-day life. And I think Leonard did just this amazing work to help guide them and help concretize what it means to live an objectivist life. So yes. A life guided by objectivism. So, you know, yes, I mean, those are terrific.
Just to mention that they have been collected. So the podcast and the answered questions have been collected to a book, which is called Keeping It Real. So one last question from me, Yaron. So many people claim that Dr. Peikoff is one of the best public speakers they've seen, and he's captivating the voice, the tonality. I'm not 100% sure what exactly it is, but there's something very specific there. At the same time, I've heard from people that that his speaking engagements involve a lot of preparation. So he mentioned it himself before the operetta lecture. I kind of get the idea that he had been nervous before giving a talk, that he had to have everything. So do you want to tell us a bit about Dr. Leonard Peikoff, the public speaker?
Yes. I mean, I can say a few things. And of course, what you don't see, because we don't have video of it, is Leonard Peikoff the teacher, which is a little different than Leonard Peikoff the public speaker. I mean, Leonard is the best public speaker, certainly in objectivism. And he's the best thinker on his feet, other than maybe Ayn Rand, in objectivism. He does Q&As better than anybody else. But he also is the best, I think, speaker. And he has this amazing ability to both have his entire lecture prepared, which he does. He has it all in writing, and deliver it in a way that doesn't appear as if he's got it all prepared. The way he speaks, the way he looks at the audience, the pacing, gives the impression that he's doing it off the cuff, in a sense, now it's all super accurate in complete sentences, although he riffs on certain issues here and there, but which is not always true of people who don't have it all written down. But he has this engaging voice. There is something to his voice. He conveys caring. He conveys for the topic, passion for the topic. He conveys caring for the audience in the sense that he wants them to understand. He's not like some public speakers who prepare it in writing. All they care about is delivering what they have in writing, right? And getting it out there, right? Leonard wants you to understand. And of course, the writing he does for speech is very different than the writing he does for a book. So for example, all the principles of objective communication, repetition, pace, and all of that is in the written form is very different than what he would do. Like you repeat yourself, even when you write out a speech, much more in a speech than you do in a written form. But he is a masterful public speaker, and he takes super, super, super complex topics in philosophy, and he makes them and breaks them down and makes them real for, I think, everybody else. And he does it at a pace and in a way, and he concretizes it and he integrates it in a way that is really people are able to absorb and able to understand. I mean, it still takes work afterwards with the content, but you get a huge amount from his lectures. So I don't know anybody else who comes even close in terms of, in particular, given the kind of material he's usually presenting. If you go back to Objectivism, State of the Art, or even the course on plays, or you know the very philosophical nature of the content. And yet he is able to convey it in a way that's understandable to the audience that is quite unique. But then also his Fort Hall Forum talks. And Leonard prepares a huge amount. He is very much, I don't mean this in any kind of negative sense, but he's very much a perfectionist when it comes to this. It has to be right. It's not quite like right like it's in a book where on every word, He focuses on to get every formulation, but it's close. He spent a huge amount of time on every one of his lectures to get the formulations right for a lecture. So not right for a book, but right for a lecture. And every one of those talks takes a lot of time, a lot of mental effort. It really is physical. It is exhausting.
Was he nervous before a talk?
I don't know. It's hard for me to say. You'd have to ask him. He definitely was. Yeah, I mean, he would think about. He was constantly thinking about it. So before a talk, days before, it almost was all consuming in terms of what he was going to deliver. But the genius of Leonard is not only does he develop these amazing talks and lectures and courses and everything. But then, so that's prepared material. That's there, and then he delivers it like nobody else can deliver it. But then his Q&As are just off the cuff. His delivery off the cuff is magnificent. And so if you've ever watched him as a teacher, that's what he could also do without. So when he taught, he didn't have fully developed lecture notes. He had outlines. And he was brilliant as a teacher and a really good teacher in terms of, again, pacing, use of voice, emphasis, passion, all the things that are important to deliver a message. I mean, he says, I think in objective communication, that it's about teaching is about it's about entertaining and indicating. And Leonard is an entertainer. He's funny. His lectures are always funny. You don't always get the sense that he's I don't think he necessarily prepares the jokes in advance, but he's funny. He's just a funny person. And he's entertaining. His voice, his passion, the way he communicates is entertaining. And he indicates, he points you in the direction of where your thinking needs to go to really understand the topic. And so he can do that in a Q&A brilliantly. he can do that in a prepared lecture, and he can do that as a teacher. He's a master at all of those.
Mm-hmm. Leonard,
and again, in the Q&As, you can see his mind work better than in anything else, in my view, because a Q&A is a new question. Often it's a new question he hasn't heard before. And it's on the spot. And and his ability in a Q&A to A, identify the core of the topic. What's the question really about? So because I see a lot of people in Q&As answering a different question than what was asked. I ask about A and they answer about B. And that's common. Almost everybody does that because they're not ready to answer A. They don't have an answer. So they answer what they're comfortable with, which is B. Very few people are good at Q&As. Leonard's a master at it. And he can get to the essence of the question and then immediately integrate it into material that you would have never expected relates to this in order to come up with something really interested, first-handed, and new to say about a topic you thought, oh, well, that's easy. I'll just say X. No, he says something completely different that's true and interesting and gives you a whole new dimension of looking at an issue. Mm-hmm.
Leonard Peikoff, the teacher, I think is kind of what a lot of people my age and younger didn't really see when we first came across him, like his podcast. It's a Q&A format, and we didn't necessarily see the decades and decades of meticulous study and teaching that he did up until that point. And we thought like, oh, this is what an objectivist philosopher does. He sits back and takes questions, and you know, and now everyone can do that. I can do that. I can get on the internet and answer, oh, is it moral to have an open lesbian relationship? I mean, today I realize, and I hope people, you know, understand it. A philosopher is at least as complex a profession as I think any type of engineer or doctor.
And for Leonard to do that in his podcast was a combination of decades and decades of studying and understanding and integrating and spending time with Ayn Rand, of course, but then writing OPA and completely integrating the philosophy. So now the application of it into life and into all these circumstances and all these strange kind of questions that you get is relatively easy. And it looks like, oh, wow, this is easy stuff. Applying objectivism is easy. Well, it's easy for Leonard Peikoff, but it takes real study. And of course, Leonard's great contribution to all of us is to shave decades off of our path to studying objectivism by providing us with OPA and Ominous Parallel and DIM, and then all the courses that he did, which basically now we have got, in a sense, a curriculum where we can study objectivism, you know, and we're studying from Leonard Peikoff. Leonard Peikoff's teaching us. I mean, he learned from Ayn Rand, but we are really all, everybody who studies objectivism today from OPA and from the courses, we're all students of Leonard Peikoff. And that is, you know, at a professional level, his main contribution to all of our lives is teaching us this philosophy, teaching us how to apply it, you know, teaching us it at a very, very, very philosophical, in-depth way, but also how to apply it to every aspect of your life, from, again, sex to art to education to, I mean, think of all the topics that Leonard in his career has covered. It is astounding. It is astounding. He had something interesting and profound to say. It's very few people ever have been able to do that in all of human history, cover so many different topics in such a deep, profound, interesting, first-handed way. It's a truly unique mind that he has and ability that he has.
Yeah. Well, we've gone over time. I'll tell people, check out your recent lecture you did about OPAR, Objectivism, the Philosophy of Ayn Rand. It comes off like you were called upon to lecture on this subject that was not a subject you chose, but you rose to the occasion and made it very personal. So I'm a fan of that lecture. I'll tell people, check that out.
Is it available? So
it's on YouTube.
About the lecture from 2021, Ocon.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if it has been already released, but it will at some point. And it's a very nice tribute.
Mm-hmm. And let me plug The Ominous Parallels. Now, there's a book. Now, Yaron, you grew up in Israel with like the aftershocks of World War II. And to a lot of people, Jewish people around the world, the Holocaust is still like the bane of their existence. And now here's a book that Ayn Rand endorsed that and helped edit or edited that like finally gives some answers and clarification. Do you remember reading that book and kind of how that impacted you?
Yeah, I mean, I think that what that book really solidifies is, you know, I mean, obviously, it was profound in terms of understanding the rise of Hitler and what actually happened. But what really, really it brought home is the role of ideas in history and how ideas shape history. And that was, to me, you know, Ayn Rand had said that, but this was like, all right, here's how it's done. And it was truly, it's an amazing book. And it seems like every decade, the United States is trying to make really making an effort to make Ominous Parallels come true. Right?
Mm-hmm. And proceed with caution. I'll remind the audience, you know, that book is after 30 years of Peikoff talking to Miss Rand. So, you know, don't try this at home. Like be very, very reluctant to speak with authority about the application of ideas to history or to anything, you know, be patient, I will suggest. All right. This has been a wonderful interview discussion. Thank you, Nikos. And thank you, Yaron, for the wonderful interview.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me on. And happy birthday, Leonard.
Happy birthday, Dr. Peikoff. I'm not as you know, I've never met him, but I'll call him Dr. Peikoff. All right, everybody. Thank you for watching. And we'll be live tomorrow, same time on The Daily Objective. Thank you and goodbye.